Thank you for joining us once again on the Delco Young Democast. My name is Mike DeEva. It is awesome to talk to you guys again. I'm still on vacation, so we still have producer Ernie taking care of some bonus episodes here for you. Today we have our conversation with Philip Block, who is running for the 168th House District here in Pennsylvania. This was a great conversation. We get into the weeds on some stuff. It's a marathon, not a sprint, but it was a really good conversation, and we hope you enjoy it. Philip Block earned his bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from North Carolina State University, then a PhD in physical chemistry from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Go Tar Heels. He works as technology director of water treatment for a chemical company in Philadelphia and has served on the Chester Heights Borough Council since 2015. Philip's running for the Democratic nomination in the 168th PA House District, which includes Chester Heights, as well as Middletown Township, Newtown Square, Upper Providence, Media, Thornbury Township, Edgemont Township, and a little piece of Marple. Philip Block, welcome to the Delco Young Democast.
Hey, nice to be here.
So we like just starting off, just getting to know people. So, you know, where did you grow up and what was your family like when you were younger?
All right. Well, I've lived all over the country. My father worked for AT&T back in the days that when you got promoted, they moved you. So I've had the opportunity of living quite a few places. Maryland twice, New Jersey three times, Kansas, California. Spent a good chunk of my life in North Carolina, moved there when I was 13, and obviously went to school there. And we moved to this area in 2001 and been here ever since, and lived in Dallas for a while too, but this is one of our favorite areas. So,
you know, was your family sort of like politically or civically active at all?
Well, I grew up in a good Reagan Republican household. The only real politics I remember is my father actually ran for the Greater Kansas City School Board back when I was very, very young. He was not successful, but I remember putting flyers under people's windshield wipers. That was a big thing back in those days, and knocking on doors, and kind of knew what he was doing, but it was just, oh, cool, my dad's doing something kind of thing. And that was pretty much the extent of it.
Nice. Well, I mean, you know, if it wasn't like a real big thing, you know, what was kind of the specific moment where you connected with politics or the political process on like a real, real base level?
Well, I've always been very interested in national politics. You know, I remember quite well getting very excited during the Bush-Clinton Perot election cycle and getting very interested in that. But it really, really took a lot of my attention actually over the last few years when I joined the Mid-County Democratic Committee and really started to want to push Democrats, especially during the Bush years, and what I thought was actually probably the nadir of our politics. Gosh, did I know what was coming after that? Who knew? But it really became important to me to push and help get Democrats elected, especially during the Bush years. And then within my town, we had a real issue that pushed me, which was high-density housing in Chester Heights. And all the townships around us are having that problem. And we had some high-density housing pushed upon some open tracts in our neighborhood. And I went to the town meetings like everybody else and was stomping mad. And my kids, being the good teenagers they are, looked at me and said, you know, quit complaining, go do something about it. And
good kids.
And, you know, so I decided to try to do something about it. And I got hooked and realized that you can really make a difference. And so since then, I've been pretty passionate about trying to do more.
That is the warning that I always give everyone. Once you start with that kind of service, you know, you're done. You're in.
It's not a slippery road.
It sucks you in.
It's
a great road, but at the same time, it's just that one start, and you're in it.
I will say, some of the people that I really, really respected, somebody like a Marty Malloy and whatnot, and we went out and did a lot for him. I do see the backside that you can get burnt out a bit.
Oh, yeah.
And not specifically pointing out Marty or anything, but I hope that doesn't, I hope I don't lose my passion. Mm-hmm. To me, so far, this has been a very exciting, wonderful process, and I hope I don't get burnt out because I always want to have that passion. And we do need to like great people. beyond me, we've got whole things that need to be fixed. And so I hope I keep going down that path. And
so it's a never-ending slippery hill.
Exactly. Just keep on going until...
Sledding down that thing forever on ever.
Until the end of the day, you say, hey, we did something great. That's
right.
The goal.
And then what's next? Yep. So you've told us a little about how you became a Democrat and, you know, what fuels you. And you're now running for the 168th. Why?
So as I mentioned, I got really involved in municipality type of politics and found out that when I won, which I actually was not expecting to win, Chester Heights had never had a Democrat on council to then. Wow. But it was worth the fight, and it's great to start small. And you know, I would always suggest anybody looking at politics, it's great to start small so you know what you're getting into. And I found out once I won that, gee, I can make a difference. So there's some things in the town. You know, I got to work with the fire department, and it had some financial troubles, and I was able to help, you know, ensure the stability of our fire department, which they're great people, looking at planning parks and really fighting for open space. And, you know, boy, I can make a difference. And that's infectious. So, you know, like everybody else, 2016 came around and everybody's pretty disgruntled. And I'm like, well, you know, I want to take it a step further because, you know, you can look at national level and it's a mess, but Pennsylvania is the same kind of mess. We have the same issues at the state legislature as we do on the national level. And I've got that bug that, you know, it's great to feel like you can do something, you're making a difference for people, and we do need good people in Harrisburg. And again, talking with my family, they got tired of listening to me complain about the elections, and we were all very saddened. You know, my family got to go to the Hillary Clinton talk in Philadelphia the night before the elections, and the next day was so dramatic, and we were just, you know, saddened by the whole thing. And we talked, it's like, we got to do something. And to me, I like the thought of running for the 168th. It, again, is a race that you can be personable. The district's small enough that you can get out and meet people, which is something that's pretty important. And yet you can make a real difference. And this is kind of the next step on trying to make a difference, trying to help people, trying to do something positive. So that's kind of what drove me. And I'm also at a point in my life that I can take this step. And try to make a difference. You know, from a professional, personal point, I've reached some milestones in that I feel like I can actually now, focus. Okay. I almost just destroyed the entire system here, but me and electronics, always a good thing. You know, that I can actually take this time and really push for this kind of effort.
And you asked your kids, and they, you know, were like, ha ha, do something about it, Dad.
Exactly. You know,
you might want to stop talking to your kids for a little. No, well, I'm kidding.
I always laugh because I've always told my kids, if something bothers you, do something about it. The unfortunate thing is, never tell your kids something you're not willing to do yourself, because it will come back and haunt you. So they said that to me, and you know, we talked about it as a family, and you know, it's pretty exciting.
So now you can be like, see, kids, I gave you a shout out on. Yes. You got to shout them out. You can shout them out.
Hey, Grant. Hey, Lauren. They're probably covering their faces when they hear this. Like, okay. Oh my God.
But, sorry.
Sorry. Not sorry.
I was going to say, we won't tell anyone, Grant and Lauren.
So what's something that surprised you in the district or in campaigning in general?
Well, it's actually been very positive. Something that has surprised me is the support I've gotten from a lot of people. And it's extremely humbling. When you start this effort, you never know how people are going to respond to you. And I've been very blessed or lucky, however you want to put it, that people actually want to hear what I have to say. They are supportive of what I have to say. They give me money, which is an amazing thing. It's crazy until you actually ask and people are like, yes, we believe in you. We give you money. We'll do this stuff. And it's an extremely humbling experience. One that, you know, on the municipality level, it was like, people supporting me, it's like, yay. But these are people I don't know. I mean, I know a lot of people in my town, but these are people I don't know that are getting excited. And it's very humbling. And I was a bit surprised on how humbling it is. It's a big responsibility. It also makes me, you know, I get this feeling that, boy, if I lose, I just let all these people down. And that's a bit surprising, too. But it's a really exciting feeling, but it's very humbling. That's been surprising. And the generosity of people and the mm-hmm. people willing to listen to what you have to say has been very exciting. People are very motivated since 2016 for sure, but as the time goes on, people get very, very motivated. And you know, I know some people that have always been motivated, right?
But I'm faking it till I make it.
But you know, you go to these meetings and you see people just like you excited, and you get caught up with the fact that everybody's focused. Mm-hmm. And then when you actually go out and knock on doors and you find out it's not just us, there are people that want to see a change, and it's very uplifting. It's very unique. I don't get a lot of doors slammed in my face. It happens every now and then, but it's really exciting to see that it's not just the people in the committees or the indivisible groups. There actually is a broader group of disenchanted people out there that are looking for changes, and that's been very exciting to see.
Awesome. Yeah, I love hearing that people are actually getting engaged.
I was just going to say, but we're both like, yay.
It is.
So to shift gears a little bit into kind of like some policy stuff, you're a scientist, you know, you've got your PhD in chemistry. Why do you think that scientific fact has so much controversy surrounding it in today's political discourse, and how would you like to kind of fight against that?
Well, I would love to see more science-based or engineering-based people in politics, because there's not a lot of scientific training at any level of our government for people that are fact or science-based. In my opinion, there has been a significant effort over the last decades on somewhat demonizing teachers, demonizing science. And you could look at it that serves a purpose. If you teach people to question everything, and this even started back in like the tobacco days or the days when we had ozone hole issues, if you have, you know, you want to sell something and you want to make a profit, it's easy to throw in a lot of pseudoscience or just lack of facts and confuse people. And if you keep saying it, people will believe it. And to some extent, a lack of knowledge gives power to certain people. You know, Marx said, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses. Sometimes a lack of education is the opiate of the masses. If you have people that are not willing to believe science, you can convince them of pretty much anything. And I think there has been a long tradition now of doing that. And it starts with demonizing teachers, which we've seen around the country, like Wisconsin and places like that, you know, where we send our kids to schools and teachers are teaching our kids, yet we demonize them as, you know, taking money from the public. Well, they're the ones that are teaching us. If you can convince people that, you know, we're not putting out carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide doesn't absorb infrared radiation and heats up the atmosphere, then you can merrily go along the way and sell as much oil as you want. It is somewhat nefarious, yet the science is clear. But as long as you keep throwing out lack of facts, cigarette smoke, I mean, look how long the cigarette industry threw out.
Decades
and how long it took, you know, when we were talking about chlorofluorocarbons from aerosol cans, who would ever think that using hairspray could damage this humongous atmosphere of ours? Well, it can. And you can spend a lot of time throwing out misinformation so you can make that extra buck. And so it is nefarious, and it's been long coming. And you know, when you have somebody on the House floor in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., bring a snowball and say, it's not, you know, climate change because it's snowing. Mm. It is a willful push to uneducate people to drive an agenda. And, you know, science is science. You know, we have theories, and sometimes, you know, theories aren't proven out, but they're science, and science should be apolitical. and here are the facts, and this is what is going to happen. And that's something I'd like to see, is more fact-based, practical legislation rather than, you know, making things up just to serve a purpose.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite quotes is Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson saying that the good thing about the truth is that it's the truth whether you believe in it or not.
Exactly.
So yeah, I mean, obviously, not just now, but on your website and a lot of other talks that I've heard you give, you know, you talk about environmental concerns real frequently. I think I read on your website that you've got like 9 or 10 patents that are related to just kind of like very broad layman's terms, kind of cleaning up pollution from air, water, and soil. Are you of the opinion that private sector innovation alone can solve all these various environmental crises, or do you think that there needs to be public policy involved with that as well?
It's both. Actually, public policy drives private sector innovation. And, you know, this is a broad answer, so I'm going to start, but if you let me go on a little while.
By all means.
This is a passion of mine. So, let me just start off by my background. So for the last 15 years, I have developed and marketed technologies, so chemistries, that clean up contaminated soil and groundwater. I've done some work on cleaning up toxins coming out of the smokestack of coal-fired power plants. And over the last few years, I've developed, with other people, it's not just me, but I've developed technologies to disinfect wastewater and treat contaminants in drinking water. And if you had all day, I'd go into tell you how what's in our drinking water that, you know,
no,
we need to approach.
No, but no, we're good.
So we got bottles here.
That's weird.
It's also in the bottles, by the way.
Yeah, but, damn the scientists.
Bottles are generally just filtered tap water from somewhere.
Right. Yeah. Water is a passion of mine in all forms and in making sure it's clean. And,
but he's drinking out of one, so we're okay.
No,
it's all right.
I'm just doomed with all of you. But
we trust you, Phil. That's fine.
So I've been very lucky as a chemist that I can mix my love of chemistry and science with my passion for the environment. Not a lot of chemists get to do that. So I've actually been very privileged in that area. But it drives me crazy when I hear people say that regulations are bad for business. They're bad for some businesses, but environmental regulations not only keep us safe, but drive a humongous business in this country. So the environmental remediation business in the United States is about a $20 billion business. So people like me designing technologies, there's consultants out there, engineers out there that apply the technologies. It's a $20 billion business keeping our soil, groundwater, air, and drinking water safe. And so if we remove a regulation to save a few jobs in a certain market, say 500, 600 jobs that are unfortunately probably not sustainable, and we remove those regulations, you're actually losing probably 1,000 high technology-oriented jobs that are designed to clean up the issues associated with keeping us safe. So, you know, public policy and regulations can actually drive public sector innovation. And that's a good thing because, in general, the money is going to come from the private sector. There, you can make a profit saving our planet. And believe it or not, and you can make a good profit to save our planet. So if you look at something like the Superfund, I assume you're all familiar with Superfund legislation corporations put money into a fund to clean up the contamination that they've left behind. One of the first ones, if you're familiar with Love Canal, where, you know, in the old days, you used to take your toxic chemicals, put them in a drum and bury them. Mm-hmm. Love Canal, just outside of Buffalo, New York. Also, we found out drums leak. It got into the drinking water and then poisoned and killed a lot of people, and hence Superfund. And, you know, so what that does is that's really bad. It's hard to clean up. But then you have corporations like mine and people like me and lots of other engineers and scientists, they need to go clean it up. And so it drives a business, but it's a business that's there to help each other. The government and all their agencies, they monitor all that, but you actually need the private companies to develop the technologies and to go out and actually do it. So it is a great marriage of government sector protecting our safety and the private sector meeting that need. And that's kind of what drives a lot in this country. And it's a great approach. But if you dismantle it by saying, well, we don't want to protect our air or our drinking water, that all falls apart. And you can actually lose a lot of jobs, value jobs, by doing that. So not every regulation is bad. It is bad for a polluter who wants to make profit, but it's actually good for companies out there trying to develop the next generation technologies to keep us safe and our environmental healthy.
What would be your first priority in Harrisburg to protect our environment and encourage green-collar economic development?
So I actually have, and it's going to come out as a policy paper here soon, I do have a 15 to 20-year strategic plan that ultimately will, if we implement it, turn Pennsylvania into basically a net carbon zero state and a leader in next generation technology. So how do we do that? And what I would do is start off is we need to implement a severance tax on frack gas. Mm-hmm. And I would take earmark about 75% to 80% of that severance tax towards incentivizing corporations, green energy type corporations, to come into Pennsylvania. So you take all that tax money, not all of it, we need some for infrastructure and other things, but you take a good portion of that tax and you use it to incentivize, say, a solar cell manufacturing company to come in and put a manufacturing facility, say, in Johnstown, where they're economically depressed. You have a wind turbine manufacturing company, you get them, incentivize them with this money to come in and put a plant in, say, the Lehigh Valley. You take a, you know, you incentivize hydrogen cell companies, put a manufacturing plant in Newtown Square. You incentivize companies coming in to develop smart grid technology. Mm-hmm. You get these companies to come in and make Pennsylvania a manufacturing and technology hub for next gen technologies. New York State's done pretty good with this, with nanotechnology. We make Pennsylvania the hub of next gen technologies. Part of that money goes into retraining the fossil fuel unsustainable jobs. And so you take these people that are currently digging coal or, you know, fracking gas, that, you know, are looking at job issues, and you train them, retrain them, help them get jobs in next gen manufacturing technologies. And so what does that do? That drives, it's gonna take about 15, 20 years to get there. Mm-hmm. It drives us into Pennsylvania becoming a source in the United States, if not the globe, of these technologies. It helps retrain a population that their jobs are starting to be non-sustainable. Because we have all this manufacturing might now, you need infrastructure to transport Pennsylvania-made solar cells and wind turbines. So it will stimulate infrastructure, and it will stimulate education, because we need to train our children and adults through our university systems to be able to design and manufacture such systems. And that can be driven primarily by a tax on shale gas. And so what that tax does is, by time we now have made ourselves the advanced next generation technology state, we're actually also obsoleting frack gas. So you can use that to drive a new technology and start obsoleting the technologies that are no longer sustainable from the environment. And so that would be the vision I have on how to drive. I mean, if you look, Pennsylvania has probably the richest history in energy of any state. They're all mostly fossil fuel based, but if you look at the fact we discovered oil here, we had this massive coal here, we now have frack gas here. Pennsylvania has been on the forefront of that. And some of our universities have actually been on the forefront of new technologies associated with those particular energy sources. There's no reason to think that Pennsylvania cannot be the leader in technology for the next generation energy systems. We should be, for the health of the economy of our state, for the long-term survivability of jobs in our state, and to ensure that we're not polluting. I mean, Pennsylvania as a state is one of the world's leading producers of greenhouse gas emissions. Not the United States, I'm talking about Pennsylvania. We need to change that. Wow. We can't be one of the bad actors. We can be a force of good. I feel like a comic book hero with the force of good. And we should be able to take the lead on that because of our rich history. And so that would be my vision. It's not going to happen tomorrow. You don't hear a lot of two-year term representatives talking about a 15-year strategy, but that is some of the thinking we need to change. And that's the kind of approach I'd like to see. Yes.
I want to go back to something that you said a minute ago about, you know, in that plan that you set forth, you had sort of, you were using some of the extraction tax to train the people who are doing the gas extraction to work on the solar cells and the wind turbines that will kill their jobs. Do you see that being a hard sell for those folks? Or,
well, I see it ultimately as the future. So at some point, our country will eventually move off fossil fuels, hopefully sooner than later.
Fingers crossed.
Well, there will probably, the way things are, always be some portion of fossil fuels in the future. Mm-hmm. But it needs to start shrinking in terms of importance. As that happens, especially in Pennsylvania, because of the history of our fossil fuels, it makes sense to at least offer the opportunity to train the workforce that is currently working in various fossil fuel type industries to the next generation industries. Mm-hmm. You can't force people to do it. It might not be a great sell, but right now, if you look at some of the places in Pennsylvania that are having, you know, economic and job related issues, it's because they're losing their jobs, either through automation. You know, no matter what our current president says, jobs and coals aren't going to come back in the hundreds of thousands, and we hope, to be honest, they don't. So you have to offer an alternative, a way forward. And the way forward is through new advanced technologies. And you can't leave the old workforce behind. You shouldn't. I mean, they've been working and providing in the state forever. You should give them the option to take part in where the state should be moving to. Is it going to be an easy sell? No, but if you're looking at, you know, you're living in coal country and your jobs aren't going to come back, maybe you want a solar cell plant in coal country where they can start, you know, really developing next generation technologies.
Man, I really hope everyone's as excited about environmental policy as I am.
You know what? Believe it or not, I wasn't until we started the podcasts and all of these things. Not that I disregarded it, but it wasn't something that I ever kind of threw my science brain into. And then these started, and then I was like, oh, like, so thanks. I mean, that's a good thing.
You know? Well, I would like to point out, I tell a lot of people, you know, as a Democrat, one of the things I love about this party is we have lots of issues. We have lots of issues. We have a lot of critical issues that we're very, very passionate about. We should be. You know, I was at a meeting the other night where people were listing issues to focus on. It was like 30 because we care.
Right.
But to me, ultimately, and every issue, you know, I don't want to pull out issues because as a representative, you know, if I can, I would like to represent every issue. But there are two issues that fundamentally we leave as a legacy to our descendants. And the first is the environment. If we screw up the environment, which we're doing, we are screwing up our legacy, not to our kids, but to every generation past us. And mm-hmm. to me, that's beyond party. I don't see how you can be, whether you're Democrat or Republican or whatever, not concerned about what we're leaving to our kids and our grandkids, because my generation, which has been doing a lot of damage, will probably be gone before the real damage occurs, but our kids and our grandkids are inheriting it. And the second one's education. If we don't educate our children, we're leaving a very, very bad legacy. Those are two primary concerns that everybody should be interested in, not just for us, but what we are leaving for our kids. So I hope people, you know, we have lots of issues, and everybody has their issues. And I'm sure at some point we're going to talk about sensible gun policy, which is another big issue, and gender equality. I mean, we have so many issues, but those two are ones we are actually can make an impact for our future generations.
So also speaking about the environment, the Mariner East 2 pipeline is slated to cut through your district On March 16th, the company building the pipeline, Sunoco, received their 40th notice of violations from the Department of Environmental Protection due to their 107th.
Wait, I have to do it. 107th.
107th.
Along with the...
finger quotes.
Finger quotes.
Yeah. Finger quotes. Inadvertent release, unquote, of drilling materials. Eye roll. Sinkholes are opening up. Safety violations are the norm. I know you've written an op to the Delaware Times, the Delco Times, about this, but can you talk about what you plan to do to protect the constituents from the pipeline?
All right, this has been an hour, so. First, I will have to point out, Mariner East 1 goes through Chester Heights. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, as I've learned, the further you away get from the pipeline, the less knowledgeable people are or the less caring they are about it. And I'll tell you in a minute why that's a danger. But Mariner East 1 started flowing this material, and they never even told us. And I'm a councilman for the borough, mm-hmm. so there's lots of issues. First of all, there's really three primary issues with Mariner East 2, and at least two of them kind of get lumped together. But there's environmental issues, which is what you just mentioned, which mm-hmm. are significant. There's public safety issues, which are paramount. And then there's personal property right issues, which not a lot of people think about. Let's talk about a little bit about those. And let's start with the environmental impact side, which is the one you brought up. Mm-hmm. There is a fair amount of damage being done to the environment. It is mostly really impacting people's drinking water aquifers and the ability of people to get clean drinking water out of it. I'm a little concerned. Everybody talks about bentonite clay, but what we don't know is what else is in that. Bentonite clay is not particularly toxic, but there are other things that are typically in drilling muds that are. So I get a little concerned because they're not necessarily required to disclose what's in their drilling fluids. And seriously, because in my profession, I deal a lot with hydrogeologists and geologists, the people who kind of study groundwater flow and ground formations. And they just seem to be inept, for lack of better words.
Was like the nicest way of putting it.
Which is worrisome, because if they're inept doing this, you got to wonder what else they're inept at. So, and it does show a significant lack of oversight by the Department of Environmental Protection. Mm-hmm. Now, in my job, I've worked with about 40 states of Department of Environmental Protection to use my product. I've worked with various environmental departments in Europe and South America and Australia. And, I know what it takes to get approval to use my products to clean up the environment. And it's a lot more difficult a process than apparently is to just mess up the groundwater that Sunoco is going through. So I'm a little amazed on the lack of teeth that the Department of Environmental Protection is doing here for this, and that needs to change to some extent. We need to, and it's more an executive branch issue than a state legislation issue, but we need to have more teeth in our Department of Environmental Protection, and it mm-hmm. needs to be focused on ensuring our environment is protected, because we're one of the few states where it's actually codified in our Constitution that our environment is to be protected. So we do need to give teeth to the environmental protection, and construction needs to stop until there's great assurance that they're not going to be causing sinkholes. And those sinkholes have problems with lots of other ones, because, as you know, they stopped Mariner East 1 flow because one of the sinkholes could potentially break that open. So, we have to ensure the environment is safe. But even more paramount is public safety. So this shouldn't necessarily be a referendum on pipelines, because some pipelines are, if they're truly a public utility pipeline, my house uses some natural gas, people have natural gas, we use fuel oils. If they were to rupture, a fuel oil line, there's environmental issues. Actually, I've vetted some products to clean that up, but they're not going to blow up and emulate neighborhoods. The material that is flowing through Mariner East 2 and 1 is a unique product, and it is probably one of the more dangerous products, if not the most, that is currently being transported through a pipeline. So it is Mariner East 2 and 1 and eventually 3 and 4 that are coming have very serious public safety issues. And again, we could talk hours on this on what they are, but it is significant. It is not a fuel oil pipeline like Sunoco likes to say. It is not even a jet fuel oil pipeline, which jet fuel is designed not to explode. Even the natural gas pipelines, which are very dangerous, we've come to live with because there is public utility to that. And if they were to blow up, I hate to say it, might take out a house or two, but it's not going to take out entire neighborhoods. The material, because it's a compressed gas that's compressed to a liquid, when the pipe ruptures, it will expand hundreds fold, and hence the radius of influence is significant. And if it was to ignite, would affect entire neighborhoods, and the number of people potentially in that zone is an order of magnitude than, say, any natural gas pipeline. So Sunoco, when they came to my borough to explain why they were doing stuff, said, oh, you know, we know how to transport, materials and fuel oils. This is not a fuel oil. This is a compressed gas that's compressed about 100 times atmospheric pressure to form a liquid. And if it was to rupture, it's going to expand tremendously and it can ignite very easily. Mm-hmm. And so it is a unique product. And of course, as you all know, it's not a public utility. Mm-hmm. So it has no value. It's not even used in the US chemical industry. That's why they're shipping it off to Scotland. We have this tremendous public safety issue, and we're not even benefiting from it. And you could talk about the economics. Really, the only one who's given out an economic plan is Sunoco. And the third part of it, which we'll get back to, is home equity. They never took impacts on home equity into the economic development of it. So there's a tremendous public safety issue. And we can talk about risk assessments. I love risk. I've done risk assessments. My only problem is the risk assessment should have been done 2 years ago and should have been used, especially when it came into high density areas like Montgomery County, especially Delaware County. The risk assessment should have been used to plan where to put the pipeline, not justify where the pipeline is. And so why we're all fighting for risk assessment, which is great, if you don't understand what your acceptable level of risk is before you do the risk assessment, then whatever number comes out of that risk assessment is going to just be used by either side. So one of the things I wrote in that article is the county really needs to sit down and think about what acceptable risk is. We all have acceptable risk. Every time you pull onto a highway, you take an acceptable risk when you drive a car. Everything we do, and just to sound cruel, is it acceptable if that pipeline blew up and once every 30 years and we lost 5 people? Mm-hmm. That might be an acceptable risk. If it blows up at once every 20 years and kills 1,000 people, that's a different risk. It may not be acceptable. So until you know what your community is willing to accept as risk, you should do that first and then independently run the risk assessment. Mm-hmm. Instead of running a risk assessment, getting a number and like, oh, it's okay, and it may not be. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. Unfortunately, again, it should have been done before the very first piece of pipeline was laid. And there's ways to make pipelines safer, so to reduce the risk, which I don't think was done either. So if you did a risk assessment and then you look at how do you reduce the risk if it doesn't meet your acceptable risk. And there are ways to reduce risks in pipelines, which wasn't done because we never publicly looked at a risk. So it's very late. I'm glad we're doing a risk assessment, but I'm a little concerned that a risk assessment will be done and it won't make a difference because we don't know what the acceptable risk is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then there's issues that either Democrat or Republican should hate. It should be not dependent on party, is that we're at serious risk from personal property rights. So, there are times that eminent domain for public utilities makes sense, which is why back in the founding of our country, they actually codified this. Because if you need a fire station or you actually need a pipeline to deliver a public utility, there is value for certain public utility rights. This is not a public utility. This, they got grandfathered into this. You know, from the history, they bought a company that used to move petroleum from Philadelphia out to the suburbs. So back, 80 years ago, we could have home heating, which was a public utility. This is a for-profit corporate venture that's been allowed to take your personal property, which is stunning. And not only take your personal property, but put us at risk. And by the way, Mariner 3 and 4 are coming. So if you don't care about Mariner 2, you know, Sunoco has claimed all of Delaware County as their public utility right of way. And the very next pipeline could be coming through your front door. So if you're not within the explosion zone of Mariner East 2, you may be for Mariner East 3 and there's nothing you can do about it. And on top of that, you know, we put our money into retirement accounts and into our home equity. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to lose 20-30% of your home equity, and some people can't even sell their houses, that is a significant impact on your retirement. And again, you don't have control over that. So what? Now let's go back to the original question. What would I do? The sad part of it is that by time I get elected and get seated in 2019, mm-hmm. Mariner East 2 is probably going to be a done deal one way or the other. So I feel strongly, you know, go out and protest. I mean, you know, I've been amazed on how some of these citizen groups have made a difference. They haven't won the war yet, but they won some battles against a multi-billion dollar company and a state legislature that is pretty much paid off by this company. Mm. So it's been very exciting for me to see how citizen groups have made a difference. So keep doing that. As a legislator, I probably won't be seated until Mariner East 2 is decided, but we still have Mariner East 3 and 4. So what needs to be done? First of all, there needs to be a change on how the Public Utility Commission operates. Right now, Sunoco got grandfathered in because they bought a company who bought a company that actually was a public utility. The Public Utility Commission, in my opinion, needs to grant public utility status on a per-project basis, not on a company basis or a historic basis. The fact that Sunoco bought into being a public utility makes no sense. The Public Utility Commission should be looking at every single project individually and determine if it's actually a public utility need or not, and really determine, you know, if there's value. This material has no public utility whatsoever. I know there's Sunoco will say differently that they put in taps, you can tap out propane, but you and me aren't going to get to use that. So they should have looked at ME2 as a standalone project and determine public utility status for that project. So that's one of the things I would change. And that was not me.
I think that was upstairs.
the way the Public Utility Commission was originally set up is that they were set up a long time ago to actually promote the use of oils out, you know, bringing utilities out from the city out to the neighborhoods. And part of their job was to actually promote the use of fuel oils and things like that. They still actually have that mandate. So their mandate is actually to promote the industry that they actually should be regulating and maintaining. So I would eliminate that part of it. We don't need to advertise and promote, you know, the use of home fuel oils out in the suburbs anymore. That may be 80 years ago, yes, today, no. So we need to move that part, separate out their oversight from this advertising part of it. So those are a couple of things that need to be done. The state, as I mentioned, EPA needs to have stronger teeth in the game where they can shut down projects. It needs to be somewhat apoliticized so that there's not pressure on them to approve things for this so-called economic benefit. They should have a mandate to look at the environmental impact period and not necessarily a so-called economic impact, you know, based on numbers that have not been vetted. So those are two things right away I think need to be done. And then there's a whole slew of legislation. And I would suggest, I got to hear Senator Annie Dinneman last week. He's a state senator in Chester. He's actually promoted a number of Senate bills regarding setting up, you know, funding from this to support people's loss of home equity in terms of emergency notifications. He's got a list of about 10 things that I would happily support to make people safer, more informed, and allowing municipalities to have more say in what comes through across their municipality borders. There's a whole list of things. He's been a very strong leader on that, and I would definitely support that on the House side. Unfortunately, most of his bills, like everything else right now, they get stuck in committee. And that's a whole nother issue on how things get stuck in committee. But I would happily support almost every, well, actually every single one of those initiatives he has put out on the House side.
Just one more reason to get some more Democrats in there. Absolutely. So that we don't get stuck in committee.
Yeah. Like the gerrymandering. I know we're jumping, but that one has such bipartisan support. This is an amendment to the state constitution to prevent gerrymandering. It has a lot of bipartisan co-signers to that bill, and the committee chair has refused to release it to general vote, which is
unbelievable.
All
right. So the other topic that you brought up a while back as one of your priorities was education. I'm sure you're aware of how bad Pennsylvania's public education funding issues are. Here in Delaware County, we've got school districts like Upper Darby and William Penn who are just scratching for any funding that they can possibly get. The Garnet Valley District, where you live and one of your kids still attends school, is fairly average for Delaware County, but it's still spending $5,000 more per student this year than, you know, those struggling districts. So what do you want to do in Harrisburg to kind of help eliminate that sort of disparity between the rich and the poor districts?
Right. So first of all, in the 168th, I do believe we actually have very good school districts. And it's interesting because I do like to talk about this topic. I'm not sure how much it will resonate in the 168th because a lot of people moved out to these towns to take advantage of the good school districts, Garnet Valley, Rose Tree Media, Marple Newtown. So we're very lucky where we live, and I recognize that. But you don't have to go very far down the street, less than 5 miles from where I live, to where you have some school districts that are in significant trouble. And as I mentioned, to me, this is a legacy. It's great to live in a school district. I'm very proud of the education my kids have gotten and you know, what I've been able to supply to them. But across the state, not everybody has that. And our kids are our resources that someday they will be taking care of us.
Hopefully.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Well, maybe my kids won't. We'll see how that goes.
I was thinking of mine as well.
No, I think they'll take care of mom. I don't know about that.
And again, to me, it is a legacy that we leave. So what can we do? The very first thing we need to do is have a fair and equitable calculation on how funds are distributed across the state. First of all, the state has to actually pay. I mean, they haven't paid even what they're supposed to. With our terrible budgeting that we've had over the last few years, we don't even pay what we're supposed to. In fact, we're one of the lower ranked states in terms of paying out what we're supposed to be paying. But even that, we need to change the formulation. So I learned going to an educational meeting, actually it was at the William Penn School, that one of the most disadvantaged school districts in the country is actually Reading. And part of the problem is, based on the current payout from the state and then the subsequent makeup with property tax, the fact is that the property values in Reading are about, and I don't know this number exactly, but I'll use it, but it's not an exact number, but thank you. I'm a scientist. I like to be held to numbers, but I don't. But they're about 20% the property value less than, say, Garnet Valley. So they're paying a higher proportion of their income in terms of property tax, yet they're still putting less in because their property is not, you know, is 20% less in terms of value than Garnet Valley. So they're getting hit twice, and, you know, they're really getting hit hard. They're not getting the equivalent funding from the state, and then they're paying a higher percentage of their income in property tax, and it's still not bringing them to the same level. So that equation needs to be changed. What I would like to see is that across the state, we have a basic payout for every student to meet a minimum educational standard that is deemed worthy enough that a student in Pennsylvania can vie for a job anywhere in this country. And that's the key thing. And there's a lot of models on how to figure that is. I'm not a big fan of standardized testing to do that model, but we need to, with the educational program, you know, the teachers associations and this Department of Education, determine what is the minimum basic that would allow any student in Pennsylvania to compete for any job in the United States. And that's what we should be funding. And then you have your property tax. And I'm not a big fan of eliminating property tax. I mean, you should have a right locally to, you know, put what you want into your school district. The school districts are, you know, if you think about it, we actually control those locally. And so you could vote for your school board and the people you want to represent you. And if you have issues with your local school district, you should be out there at the school board meetings and fighting for what you want. So I do believe that we should be able to pay some of our taxes into making our schools better. But at minimum, we have to fund on an equitable basis across the state so that every student has a good playing field to start from. In almost everything I believe in, you know, from equality across the board, it's all about making sure everybody has the same starting playing field. If you start somebody because they're affluent and of a certain race at a very high level, and you disadvantage somebody because they're economically disadvantaged and of another race way below, that's not fair, in better words. As long as you start with an even playing field and in education, that means funding so that, again, any student in Pennsylvania has the opportunity to get a good job anywhere else in the country, that's a good starting basis field. And then, you know, you have a right to move and put monies into your school district. And that's where the local people can, you know, push their school districts to raise standards above that. But I think it needs to be a mix. But we are not even doing the basics to ensure an even playing field. And so you need to start with that equitable funding equation. And for the more economically depressed areas, make sure that people are not paying a higher percentage of their wages to not even make up the property tax to get them to that equal playing field. So it starts with that equation.
So you have kids.
Yes.
I have kids. And kind of keeping on that whole school aspect, school safety is obviously a huge topic right now. There are people pushing for enhanced security measures in schools, up to including arming teachers and staff. I know, I do the same thing.
I rolled my eyes for those of you.
Say,
this is not a video, I just
rolled
my eyes.
And I was going to say collective eye roll across the table. We just talked about funding being an issue. So what do you think is the best way to keep schools safe?
Well, let me just start. I cannot have another conversation with my daughter about being safe in school. I'm sure you all feel it is amazing that I have to sit down and talk to my kids about the issue of people getting, you know, students their age getting shot in school. When I was a kid, you know, the scariest thing we had was a razor blade and an apple at Halloween, which wasn't even real.
No,
that was the boogeyman we have. We have real boogeymen, real ones, about, you know, think about our children going off to school every day with the potential of them getting shot. And it's just, it's so part of their lives now. You know, it hurts me as a parent to have that conversation. To them, they're like, yeah, we know. And the fact that, yeah, we know, shouldn't even be part of our dialogue. No, we should not arm teachers for several reasons. One, teachers have a job to do and they need to focus on it. They are not policemen. They're not military people. They shouldn't be required to be. That's not their job. Their job is to teach my children to be smart, responsible people in society. And then, as actually has happened twice now in the last 2 weeks, imagine a teacher shooting a child, either by accident or if there's an active shooter and they miss and shoot kids. We don't need other people. It's a tough enough job for police to enter that situation. As we saw, sometimes they don't. It's a tough enough job to enter an active shooting situation if you are a trained police officer. Teachers will never get that. And it's not going to stop people from doing it just because they think a teacher might have a gun. That's not going to stop the issue. So to me, that's a non-starter. I think our high schools are actually already pretty well hardened. If you look at what Parkland, it really didn't have much to do with hardening. The guy got everybody to come outside. So we're not going to have, you know, somebody pulls a fire alarm, you're not going to leave the building. Right. That wasn't an issue. If you go to most, I haven't been to every high school here, but you can't get in anymore. That wasn't even the issue. So what are you going to harden? You're going to put barbed wire around the thing, and then when the kids come outside the barbed wire, what are you going to do? You're going to it's not the issue.
Yeah, it's called a prison once you get to that point.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I don't want my kids going to prison. So. You know, what is it going to take? First of all, we do need to eliminate assault-style weapons. I do love history. This is not actually, regardless of what is said, is not what the Second Amendment was set up to do. Assault-style weapons are there for killing people, and that's what they're there for. And if you actually follow the money, they're really there because the military manufacturers were running out of people to sell guns to, so they convinced our government to allow their production lines to be made now for, you know, civilian military weapons. So it's all about money, and it's not about sport. It's not about any of those real, right to bear arms issues. It's just about, you know, money and politics, and it's terrible. We need to eliminate them. There's no reason for them. We do limit arms all the time. You know, you can't walk down the street, whether you want to or not, or how much you want to, with a bazooka or a rocket grenade launcher. I know probably some people feel like that every day. So as a sensible society, we can decide what is a reasonable arm to bear and what is not. And we have lots of arms that have been classified as not reasonable to bear, and we don't seem to have a problem with it. These should not be allowed to begin with. So that's a step. And I always like to point out that the Constitution also promises us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life is first there. Whether it's schools or going to a concert or to a music show, you shouldn't in this country have the fear of being shot. I mean, that is part of freedom. I should be free to enjoy the things around me. And if you have to worry about being shot by some crazy person with a semi-automatic or automatic weapon, that's not freedom. That's not, you know, the ability to walk down the street and enjoy everything that our country has to offer. And the Second Amendment never was originally set up to do that. Military weapons were kept at militia armories. And hence, that's why it says in the Second Amendment, you know, well-regulated militia. There's a reason the British attacked Lexington and Concord. That's where the military weapons were. There's a reason in the 1850s, Harper's Ferry was attacked to get the military weapons. Because, one, they couldn't afford the military weapons. We mass produce them now so you can afford them. But back then, to have a military-grade musket or rifle was very expensive. They couldn't even afford it. So it wasn't till recent history that the Supreme Court started deciding that pretty much any weapons, you know, it actually wasn't until 2008 that the Supreme Court made its first decision that weapons are available to everybody. That's only 10 years ago. Before then, there's 200 years of Supreme Court decisions that, you know, military-style weapons didn't get into the hands of people. So we need to, as a society, start looking at what we consider as sensible, you know, gun policy. And part of that, to be honest, is to take money that, say, the NRA and other manufacturing-related issues, get it out of politics. And, you know, one way to do that is to vote for people that are not beholden to that kind of money. And I'm not talking about taking away sports rifles and things like that. There's value. There's real valid reasons for that. We're talking about weapons of mass destruction for the most part. The other side of that, by the way, is actually one of the leading causes of death in this country is suicide by handgun. So there are issues around preventing a lot of the deaths associated with people using handguns on themselves and on others. But I'm not even really talking about handguns today. I'm just talking about the people that are making our schools unsafe are using these weapons of mass destruction. And there's really no reason for them other than it's a political, you know, lever to push a certain voting population, and the money that is being pumped into it from, manufacturing societies. We need to take a step back. That's how we do it. That's the first step. And then talk about hurting schools and then talk about mental health. But let's take away the real issue that nobody seems to want to talk about.
Absolutely.
On your website and in interviews, you've discussed being a champion of equal rights for all, particularly women. What specifically does that mean to you?
All right, so I do have a policy statement on my website, and I'll give myself a little plug. That's www.philiplock4pa168.com, and you can find that there. So there are some very specific policies that I would like to see. So gender equality, and I will say I'm very passionate about equal rights for all, gender equality as well as people of color and the LGBT community, immigrant. I mean, everybody should be treated the same, just straight off. But let's talk about gender equality. I will never truly understand what it's obviously like to be a woman and have issues in the workplace. I see what's happened to my wife. We both actually have the same degree. We met in grad school, and although I was 4 years ahead of her, you know, my salary's always been commensurately higher than her, which drives me crazy. I would love her to make more money than me. And the fact that, you know, the opportunities in the harassment issues, do stun me to this day. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but things do have to change. So if you look at Harrisburg, I'm very supportive of a lot of the legislation, very supportive. I am. I mean, I would vote for it today. Of the Me Too, movement and the legislation that's been proposed by Representative Kruger Braneke as an example, and basically ensuring that women can come out and say what they have to say without fear of reprisal. What I would like to see beyond those kind of things is also, real whistleblower protection for women. I would like to see that the state employees and the legislatures held to the same level that industries are with respect to harassment claims and issues, and they're not. So they need to be. I would like to see the ethics board removed out of the state legislature. It is crazy to me that people are in charge of viewing ethics when they themselves are having ethics issues. And you can look at Meehan on the congressional side. Right. He's on the U.S. Congressional Ethics Committee, and he's a great offender of it. It's crazy. It's the foxes guarding the foxes. It's not even guarding the hen house. It's foxes guarding the foxes. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see, as an example, the House and Senate Ethics Committees moved out and put into the judicial branch. Or maybe even a citizen-related one, but all ethics-related issues should be, say, done by seasoned judges of both parties and of equal balance between men and women, so that you take the lack of ethics that a ethics committee has governing itself and move it into a separate branch of government and make it bipartisan and make, you know, at least an equal number of men and women on that so that the actual ethics complaints can be dealt with seriously and there's and they're not guarding themselves. In addition to that, I would like to see things along the line of real support for, you know, pre-K and kindergarten support. So as an example, if you live in a community that doesn't have, you know, either free or affordable services like pre-K or kindergarten, and you are a woman in with that, you know, has a disadvantage economically, you shouldn't have to make a decision, do I stay home and watch my kids for the benefit of the family, or do I get a job and help support the family? And it's not even economically depressed. Anybody, any woman or man, should have the right to go make a living without having to worry about what's going to happen to my kids. So we need to have a state program that funds early education and takes away the stigma of having to stay home versus earning a living to help pay for food for your family. That's a woman's right. You know, we need to ensure equal pay for equal work. I think that is a requirement. You know, Iceland did that. You know, Iceland's leading the way. We need to have, I'd like to see it nationally, but at least on the state level, that you get equal pay for equal work. That should be a given. You know, I've been blessed that I've had a career that I've worked for companies that have been very good on gender equality. I've had the opportunity to lead large groups made of men and women. And, you know, for the most part, you know, the companies I've worked with and how I try to lead my life, you know, I view people as their ability in terms of intelligence and what's in their heart. And, you know, if you work for a company, it's about making a profit. And I would never not select somebody or promote somebody who's making a profit and doing the right thing. It makes no sense to bias against somebody if they're actually good for the company or good for whatever they're doing. And we need to have that in the state legislature. You can't allow anybody to be harassed. And again, we can't be having a review panel run by the people that are doing the issues. That needs to be separated out, and we need to make sure we have equal pay for equal women. And then I'll extend it. That goes to the LGBT community, that goes to the African American community, the Latin community, the immigrant community. Again, everything is about providing an even playing field. One of the things about, I believe truly in this country, is that if you're given an even playing field, you have the ability to reach for the stars. But if you're put in a hole, then reaching for the stars is almost takes it out of human capacity to do that. We need to give everybody the same chance, and that goes across that whole board. So please check out my position paper on gender equality and where I stand on that. It's very important.
So your opponent is, of course, a female.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just discussing, you know, gender rights and, you know, equality and so forth and so on. So as a female, she's lived this personally, you know, the ups and the downs. How are you going to give your message about being that equal fighter for those kind of rights? And to be that advocate as, I guess how, oh, that's hard.
Let me try to answer, because I think I know what you're asking.
No. But what I'm trying to say is, like, I mean, you're both, you know, passionate about this. As a man, how are you going to, you know, advocate that you have this, you know, at the forefront?
Well, first of all, let me start by saying you don't have to be a woman to be a feminist. It's interesting enough, what's happened because of this primary, it's put me in a personally interesting situation that being an advocate for gender equality, I've been told by some people that I'm actually not a good advocate for gender equality because of my gender. And Yeah, well, I'll be honest, it bothers me a little bit because this is something I'm pretty passionate about. And again, you know, because I'm a man, I will never truly understand a lot of the issues, but that doesn't mean I can't fight to make sure everybody's treated accordingly. And I'm a bit naive. I see a vision, and I live by this, and that, again, to me, irregardless of who you are, not just gender, but every other, who you love, the color of your skin, whatever it is, I judge people, and I have an expectation that other people should judge people by what is, you know, in their head and what's in their heart. Those are the things that count. Everything else is packaging. And by the way, having different packaging is great. I mean, you know, otherwise it would be a pretty boring place. But everything else is packaging. And I know that sounds naive, and I'm willing to have that naivete because that's where I want us to be someday.
Right.
We may never get there because humans are frail and we have our issues. But to me, we need to get there someday. So I'll be that naive, knowing that someday we're going to get there. I do have a position statement on this. And what I wrote in that is what I will do and what I believe in and what I will fight for. And so you can go to my website or you can email me. I'll send it to you.
And don't spell it out. It is the
Philip Block,
right?
Number 4 PA168.com.
And that's Block with a B-L-O-C-K.
Correct.
Not just a C.
Yeah, B-L-O-C-K. That's a whole nother, my issues with Facebook issues.
That's okay. But, well,
me and my fight with Facebook. That's a whole nother story. So I've spelled out what I believe in, what I will support when I'm in the legislature, the current bills that are out there, and then the additional things I would like to see. I hope people believe me. They're not just words. I feel very fortunate that a lot of very strong political-minded women Democrats in this district and the county do support me. It's hard to know if you should support me if you haven't personally met me and talked to me. So please come meet me and talk to me. Otherwise, you have to take it on face value of what I'm saying. But I wrote down what I believe in, what I want to do, because that is what I will do. And there's actually more things to do than just what's on that. But that's the minimum that we need to do. And I'm passionate about it. And I'm not going to get into, you know, if there are people out there that, you know, don't feel comfortable voting for me because of my gender and that I can't be a good champion of it, well, you know, I understand it. I can't change my gender.
No. So, but it's interesting.
But I'm not going to. I talked to my wife about it. It's not going to happen.
It's one of those things that I've noticed across the board, really. And it's not just your race. It's not just any other race. It's even the district, the dreaded District 5 has that same kind of mentality. You know, Year of the Woman and so forth and so on. So when we do, you know, especially I'm sitting at a table with, you know, three gentlemen, you know, I know that each one of you sitting here, you know, are going to be that kind of, you know, person that stands and, you know, champions. But it is, you know, it's a tough question.
It's
an interesting way of hearing how you guys, you know, answer it. And I love, you know, how passionate you do get about it, which is, you know, fantastic.
Again, I may not truly understand what it's like to receive that.
Right.
I will say, you know, I lived in the South as a Jewish person, and so there was a whole nother set of things that I kind of experienced. But I will never truly understand it. But that doesn't mean I can't be a champion to solve those issues. And, you know, that's me. And
I love that.
Thanks.
That's
so
awesome.
Come, if you don't know me, come meet me. And it is my effort over the next how many months to knock on as many doors, and I have a campaign office. You can come see me, and I go to events. Come see me and see if
I can drop that too. Where the campaign office is?
Oh, yeah, I do have a campaign office. I'm actually subleasing space from a congressional candidate because he really offered a great deal. It's in Media, so it's in the center of the 168th. It's on Baltimore Avenue, 2 West Baltimore Avenue. Which is really basically near the corner of Jefferson and Baltimore. So, you know, come see me. Now, a lot of times I'm out knocking on doors, so if you want to make sure I'm there, call me first. But, you know, I'm trying to make myself as available as possible. And by the way, when I win this seat, I pledge to continue to do that. So unless I'm on vacation, I'm planning to hold weekly town hall meetings. Well, you know, it would be nice if some of the current
we don't know what those are.
At least one or two, and especially, you know, around the district, because, you know, I'm running to basically represent people. And if you just keep yourself in Harrisburg or D.C. and you don't actually listen to people, irregardless of party or whatever, you're not really doing your job. So, but I want to, you know, come meet me and be happy to talk about this issue, you know, face to face.
So, the 168th hasn't been represented by a Democrat since it was created almost 50 years ago. Mm. Your general election opponent, Chris Quinn.
I was just going to say, for those, yet again...
That was not a sneer on my side.
No, yet again, that was... This isn't a video moment, and we all just kind of were like... Oh.
No, it was a sneer, snicker, eye roll, twitch, everything thrown in. He's only held the seat since 2016. What do you think makes you the person to take him on?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have to give a shout-out to Diane Corman Levy, who ran 2 years ago. She was a phenomenal candidate, and I'd probably vote for her if she was running this time, too. So she should have won. So what? There's a lot of things today in 2018 that I believe makes this district winnable. I don't want to go into too much detail right now because I don't want to give away my strategy. But Mariner East 2 is an issue, which I don't think... my general election opponent is on the right side of. He's trying to get on the right side of it, but people in Middletown have long memories, and so I think that's an issue. I think in general, if you look at the Republican-controlled majority, I don't, you know, is not doing a good job. And even if you're a Republican, they're not doing a good job. The whole issue, and we didn't really talk about budget here, but the budget they just passed is a farce. And what's happened to the credit rating of the state is that we have been consistently dropping in credit rating, which has real impact on the amount of money our state can borrow and the cost of borrowing money. And that impacts all of us, our taxes, job creation. So the lack of the Republicans to pass a reasonable, sensible budget has direct pocketbook impact on everybody in this district and the state. And I also have a corporate business background. I work for a corporation. I've run, you know, budgets of $50 million. I do understand the need to make profits, the need to generate jobs. I think we can do that environmentally soundly and you know, with good democratic ideals. But there's a lot, you know, of my experience that I think, you know, for a moderate Republican would make a lot of sense, especially when we're talking about jobs, to be honest, with job generation and new, you know, alternative energy technologies that, you know, the Republicans used to believe in things like personal, you know, property rights. There's a good story there that crosses parties that I think we can make. And then just the general angst over what's happening at the federal level, and again, is mirrored in what's happening in the state level. Again, I think as a whole, that crosses political boundaries too. So 2 years ago, I think Diane didn't have some of these issues that would have, you know, helped propel her to win. We had these issues this time. And we do still have a majority Republican, at least registered vote count in the 168th. So, you know, it's not just getting Democrats out, but I really do have to appeal to a certain population of the Republican Party. And I think I have that ability with my business background, with my stance on, you know, what the pipeline's doing to personal property rights and to issues with the budget and how we need to take more a sensible approach and not pay for the 2018 budget with 2019 money, as an example, and looking for alternative sources of fundraising. I think it's a very good story this year. And obviously, I believe this district can be won and have the first Democrat. And just the excitement of what's happened in the county and getting the first Democrats on county council. I think people like to see more of a balance, mm-hmm. a party, and not domination by one, so that there may be some chance of bipartisan work, and not things just getting stuck in committee that we really need to see happen. So I think we actually have the story this year. I'm very excited about it, very positive about what we can do this year.
Just to kind of wrap things up, you know, we obviously kind of gear the show towards a younger audience. You know, what...
some of us are... I won't take that personally. But,
no.
He's really 300 years old, yeah. Seeing him.
We're hoping you can tell your kids. No,
we laugh at home. I'm an old Jewish white guy, so I got Bernie Sanders down. If my hair was just a little bit more messed up, you got Bernie Sanders.
I love it.
Now, let me be clear. So, you know, given that, you know, what are the other issues that you think the younger, you know, quote-unquote millennial and Generation Z voters are going to be sort of focusing on and getting them excited?
So, to me, the biggest issue is the concern over not having a voice, especially in the Democratic Party. And I'll tell you, I love the Democratic Party. It's about getting Democrats elected and getting things changed. But I see the angst, especially certain Facebook sites and in general after the 2016 election, the lack of voice. What I would say to that is you have a voice. Actually, you have, and I always, you know, point this out, we every single citizen has two arrows in our quiver, and one's the vote and the other is our pocketbook, and they're both very strong, and you have a voice. You don't like the way directions are going either politically or within the party, become active, get in there. You can change the Democratic Party to what you want it to be. You have to come and become a committee person and change it. You know, for the younger crowd that has this energy and you see it in the resistance movements, there's a great deal of energy. Apply that energy also to the party. The party needs younger voices. The party does need new direction. But I don't want to sound bad, but you can't just complain about it. You don't like the way the Democratic Party is doing something, then become a member, come to the meetings. Run for committee. Mm-hmm. We have somebody right here who's running for state committee to make a difference.
Actually, two of us.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. So, and that is the key, right? And I'll diverge here a bit because I hear a lot about why isn't the Democratic Party bringing in the resistance groups and why the resistance groups mad at the Democratic Party. To me, there's two approaches to get something done, and they're not opposed to each other. They both need to be done. You have the resistance groups, which thank God they happen, but unfortunately they happen as a result of Trump and didn't happen early enough to prevent that. Yeah. But those are the ones that get out, march, make the issues known, right? They're the voice of the issues. They're the voice of standing up for, you know, safety, for sensible gun policy. Thank goodness for what the kids have done recently. That's where you hear the voice. That's where you hear the passion. It's the party and legislative side, though, that cements the action in place. So you can protest and get a change, but it's the party and the politician that cements it. They are not opposed. They actually really are the same goal.
Right.
Just two different approaches, and they both need to be done. But that doesn't mean if you don't like the way one of it's going, you got to get involved in both. You can't be a resistance person and say, we hate the Democratic Party because they're not listening to us. Well, then you need to become part of the party and change the direction. The party's just made up of people. people that are very passionate about going out and getting Democrats elected. That's the primary goal of any party. And it's filled with a bunch of people who knock on doors, who man the polls, who make sure that people come out and vote, who sit there, work the long hours, checking people in at the polls. You cannot get anything done without those people. You also need the people out there with the passion and making the issues known, getting the TV cameras out there so that the average voter gets pumped up. They're both part of the same coin. They're both sides of the same coin. And so, you know, I would say to the young people, if you're mad, do something about it. I told that to my kids, and I'm paying for it. I pay for it now. So
we didn't talk to your kids before we decided committee, but you know, we might just claim
so,
it.
You know, so my advice, you know, is the passion is great. It is now time to do something. When I was in my 20s, it was Reagan time, and there was everybody loved money, and you know. I wasn't a big fan of Reagan, but nobody had passion. Nobody had, you know, Bill Clinton was the first time I saw actually young people getting passionate about it. And it was great to see Obama. The passion actually came out in a presidential candidate. Unfortunately, we seem to have stepped back. Now's the time to get that passion out and make a change. And make that, you know, and we all should make that change. It shouldn't be party versus resistance. They're the same thing. I got it too excited. They're the same thing. So, and then I actually also mentioned the wallet. The other thing that people don't really pay attention to is that your wallet is a very, very strong arrow. And we all talk about the evils of money in politics, and it's terrible. Citizens United was, a slam on a democracy, right? And we could spend hours talking about that. But if you don't like money in politics, then make sure you're not giving your money to the evil actors in that. One way to control the corporate boardroom is to have their profits drop because nobody is buying their product. I hate to go back to the 60s, but that's what Rosa Parks did, right? Mm-hmm. The whole, you know, we're not going to use the bus system changed, had a massive change of civic action due to hitting the pocketbook of basically the city. And, you know, you don't like what certain corporations are doing in pumping money into politics, don't buy their stuff. But it's too easy to go out and buy a $20 DVD player and not realize where that money's going to. Or, you know, you got to be a very smart, savvy consumer if you really want to be a political mover. And it's in that pocketbook is almost more important than the vote sometimes. In fact, if you look at what's changed since Parkland, I love the passion, but what's really changed is some corporations have decided not to sell automatic weapons, and that's where the change is going to happen. The corporate dollar can be used for evil, but you can force them to use it for good too. So that's my take on, you know, use that passion and use your vote to vote in the right people. Join the party and use your vote to get the party to do what you want, and use your pocketbook to help try to control that corporate money aspect of it.
Awesome. Philip Locke, thank you so much for joining us on the Delco Young Democast.
Great time. Thank you.
Thank you.
So there we have it. A couple thank yous real quick. I want to shout out the band Tin Mouth for letting us use their song Generation to Generation as the theme song for our show. Please check us out on social media. We're on Facebook at Delco Young Democast. You can also find us on Twitter at DY Democast. You can email us. My email address is mike@delcoyoungdemocast.com. We really appreciate you guys listening, and we will talk to you next time.